Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
Who really knows the full story? My son, recently, 2 or 3 months ago, out and out asked Alpha, his mother, is Melissa alive? And she said, I don't know. And he looked her in the eyes. She said, it's Melissa alive. And I guess Alpha looked back at him and says, how would I know? Thank God we're finally getting some help here. But no, he's upset about it. Just give up. She threw up her hands, and that's her personality and her nature. As far as I know her, she's always been that way. My gut feeling is that Alta didn't harm her. She was kidnapped. She was kidnapped, and she was given to a good family somewhere. And she's probably had a good life.
Last week, we brought you the first part of Melissa Highsmith's story. On August 23, 1971, one-year-old Melissa was abducted by a woman who had responded to a classified ad her mother placed in the local newspaper. Or at least that's the story that Melissa's mother and roommate told the police when they reported her missing. But we've learned that there's no actual proof Melissa was abducted. And while she is officially classified as a stranger abduction, we believe that we found significant indications that Melissa may have never been abducted at all. And that's just the beginning of this 50-year-old stone-cold mystery we've been chipping away at. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 372 of The Vanished. Melissa Highsmith's story, part 2, A Delicate Thread Unraveled. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Last week, we brought you the beginning of Melissa Highsmith's story. We left off the episode with many questions, including serious considerations about what had actually happened to her. The story didn't make sense to us, and as we moved into production with the second part of Melissa's story and started pressing harder and digging deeper for facts, we learned some disturbing revelations, that most of what we had been told that was portrayed as fact was not anything beyond speculation on one family member's part. These developments threw everything we thought we knew into question. So the story we had planned to tell you today has changed to sharing with you what we do know, based on first-hand accounts only. We want to take a moment to recognize that the Highsmith family is missing a daughter and a sister. Their family has gone 51 long years without being complete. Everyone grieves and behaves differently when they have a missing loved one. So we don't want to discount that they are victims of the tragic loss of Melissa. With that in mind, we began with Alta. We had a lot of questions. Why did Alta only place a one-day ad in the local newspaper? How come she seemed ambivalent about finding Melissa when we talked to her? Why did we feel like this story wasn't adding up? These weren't the only questions we had, but in choosing to tell Melissa's story based on only first-hand information, we started with her mother, the only person we spoke to who saw Melissa on the day she vanished. We asked her about what took place in her life after Melissa was gone, and about her reunification with Jeff after Melissa's disappearance, and how they came to have 4 more children together.
I got another job, and I can't remember what that place was called, and I found an apartment. My brother did help me get a car. He was there. I don't know why he showed up at Fort Worth. I don't know if he moved back or he heard what was going on and came to see me, and I don't know. But anyway, he helped me get a car, and I had another job, and I tried to move on with my life, you know. After I had moved on with my life and got everything settled, I mean, you know, I didn't hear anything from the FBI or anybody for a long time. And after I got settled and was just getting to the point where I could take care of myself, he shows up and thinks we ought to get back together. And at first I didn't want to, but then he finally talked me into getting back together. He had started going to church, and he wanted to get right with God. And so I went back with him, and I did forgive him. And, you know, we got in church, and we had four kids after that. And there was a couple of times between the time we got back together and the time the kids were starting to grow up that there was a couple of times that people tried to get me interested in these people that could help me out, you know. One was I don't know if she was a psychic or what, but I think she worked with trying to help people find their kids. And she gave us a clue of somebody in Texas that looked like Melissa. So we checked that one out, and it came to nothing. And there was another time, I don't remember what that was. But after those two times, I thought, you know, forget it. You know, she's gone. We have to move on, you know. And I did. I moved on. And I raised my four kids. And, you know, I know they didn't replace Melissa, but it helped.
Alta and Jeff did have four more children. But their lives were far from perfect. And it seemed that things were often tense. Jeff told us from his perspective about his return to Fort Worth and to Alta after Melissa vanished.
I actually, whenever I came back to Fort Worth, I asked Alta to come back to me. Let's see, we got back together in 73, and I left in 98, so 25 years back together again with four children later. So Sharon, Rebecca, Jeffrey, and Vicky are the results of us being together the second time. Melissa was the child of us being together the first time. But that was about a year and a half later after Melissa was kidnapped and she decided to come back to Illinois. Well, 29 years later, we divorced again. This is what I worked a lot. I'm a hard worker. I worked a lot. I was gone a lot. And then I kind of probably shouldn't have been gone as much. But of course, we had the four children. I don't feel that Alta was happy being the mother of four children. I believe it was too much of a responsibility for her. She had a hard time with stress. And I believe her children will tell you the same thing. And she would get upset and stay upset for months at a time. And she was very unhappy in the marriage with her position. We was in church. We, you know, I got in church and started going to church. But she was really unhappy with being the mother of four children. And I don't know, she just would be angry all the time. It was terrible for her, and it was terrible for me. She was upset all the time. I slept on the couch more than I did in bed. So that's because of her anger. And that wasn't healthy. Now, there were several times that she was really angry and had a bad, really, really bad spirit with my children. It was all I could do to get between the children and her. She was always wanting to discipline them. And of course, I'm a lot easier going. And I didn't like disciplining the children much, but I was the one that had to do it because she wouldn't do it. She made me do it. And she just was too aggressive with discipline, I think. it would be whenever they got older, like toddlers and on up. She just didn't have the capacity to nurture my children. She didn't have it. It just wasn't there. She took care of the kids real good. She dressed them good, and they were clean, and they were fed. But as far as the love and the nurture and the, you know, what a mother does, she didn't have it to give them. I don't want to say how I really feel way down deep, but I just know she can't take a lot of stress. I don't want to hurt anybody in any way. My kids are Alta. I don't want to hurt her in any way. I'm not one of those kind of ex-husbands that want to harm anybody. You know, I really care for Alta. She's just impossible to live with.
Alta's own difficult childhood that we shared with you in the first episode of this story appeared to have a profound effect on who she became as a parent. In the first part of Melissa's story, you heard from her sisters Sharon and Rebecca, but you didn't hear from her third sister, Victoria, who appears to have been on the receiving end of the brunt of Alta's unresolved childhood trauma. This is some of what she told us.
My mother and father raised us in a Pentecostal home. We went to church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, Saturday night. We went to church that many, and then we was at every event the church had going on. Church camp, parties, events. We lived sheltered. We didn't have a TV. We weren't allowed to go to middle school basketball games. We couldn't cut our hair, couldn't wear makeup, couldn't wear jewelry. We had to wear skirts and dresses to our ankles. And when I would walk home in like the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, oh my God, people used to throw rocks at me on the way home and follow me. I had like 10 girls jump on me in the bathroom. Another girl stabbed me in the head with a pencil. I had this boy that liked me. He used to throw me into the lockers and trip me. And I mean, oh my God. By the time I made it to the 9th grade, I quit and was pregnant with my first child at 15. Girl, if I wrote a book about my life from as far as I can remember, from my mother, from growing up to where I'm at now, people would be blown away. My mother, she always used to scream and holler at us.
Melissa's dad, Jeff, told us a startling story about something he remembers happening to Victoria when she was elementary school aged, one day when Alta was angry.
She was very angry. She's very angry at Vicky. She pushed her down and she shoved her against the radiator and it busted her head open. She was 6 or 7. But, you know, for the most part, I didn't see any physical abuse or child abuse. I mean, other than that, of course, she was verbally abusive to him. She was emotionally abusive to him.
For her part, Victoria has recovered from the physical abuse and trauma miraculously well. In fact, today, Alta lives in Victoria's home. And Victoria told us how she went from feeling like she was treated as the most hated child to forgiving her mother and enjoying what she described as a good relationship with her.
I always feel like that I was the child my mother did not want. And I felt like that my whole life growing up. I always told myself, man, when I have kids, I'm going to tell them 10 times a day how much I love them, because I can count on one hand from as far back as I can remember until I was a teenager, my mom telling me she loved me on one hand. I'm in therapy, and that's why I'm in therapy too. I've learned, I grew up all my life thinking everything was my fault. But now that I'm in therapy, I learned I was the child. The parents were responsible, not me. They were the responsible ones to protect the children, and they failed at that. And that's not my fault. But I was a broken child that became a broken adult and went from one broken relationship to another broken relationship. I don't know. I love my mother. My mother lives with me. And I'm taking care of her, and she'll probably live with me till she takes her last breath. Growing up, we had a volatile relationship. But now that I'm older and wiser and have forgiven my mother, you know, she's with me. And I love her to death, and I wouldn't trade her for anything in the world.
If there's anything positive about Melissa's story, it's that all four of her siblings are able to maintain good relationships with Alta, despite her difficult and uncooperative behavior, not only as a mother, but as a wife and person, who was never properly cared for as a child herself. Their four younger children were raised without ever knowing their missing sister. But Victoria told us that Jeff kept her memory alive by showing them photos and telling them about his memories of their older sister.
I was about 8 or 9 when my dad told us about our missing sister and showed us news clippings and showed us a picture, sort of showed us several pictures of him and my mother and Melissa together and different pictures they had. And they told us that someone had took the baby from my mother, you know, and explained the word kidnapped. And I was like 8 or 9 when I was told that. That's when I remember. And I think my sister was like maybe 9 or 10 because we're about 11 months and 2 weeks apart. So Rebecca, which would be older than me, I think like we tried to talk to my mom about it when we were little and she got really angry. And my dad said that we probably shouldn't talk to my mom about that, because it was too hurtful for her, and she would always be real emotional. My mom, I remember my mom not being a very happy person my whole life. Like, she was, Melissa being kidnapped probably changed her forever. And I think the fact that she never got over that, and that she became a parent of 4 more children, there was a disconnection with her children, all of us. There is a disconnection, and I think it was because her child was kidnapped. And I just think it changed the way she was a mother. She's 73 now, but I think she was only about 21, maybe 22. My dad was only about 21. They were both really young, you know. My dad has been on his own since I think he was 12, 13. So when that happened, I don't think he was ready to be a father. I know my mother has shared, and this is the first time my mother shared this with me, that he ran off. This was even before Melissa got kidnapped. I just found this out like weeks ago. Ran off and was with some other woman. And my mom had to go to work to provide. And she had a roommate. And this, you know, that's the story I heard from my mom. And then I asked my dad about it. And he said, man, I was young and dumb and stupid. But he also came back and had 4 children with my mother and was an amazing provider for all 4 of us. So I can't fault him for a decision he made when he was 20 or 21, because, you know, he might have not been ready to be a father. And I'm sorry my mother went through that.
Melissa's sister Sharon also has many memories of their dad talking about Melissa and making sure his children knew as much as they could about the sister they never met. But her mother spoke of Melissa only with a tone that seemed almost hostile.
The amount of torment that it does to me, like, I'm 44 years old. I've been hearing this story for as long as I can remember. My dad would bring out the file folders on Melissa, and he would show us the articles, the clippings, real clippings of newspapers. And the pictures, actual pictures that you can touch, old pictures that they had. And he would tell us about Melissa, and he would lament, and he would be sad, and he would tell us, and he wanted us to know that there was this sister that we had that we were still looking for. And the first time I ever asked my mom about Melissa, I was, I don't know, I think 25 years old, and we were on a long road trip in a car together for several days. And I said, Mom, can you talk to me about Melissa? I can't even imagine like what kind of trauma that was. And can you tell me about what happened during that time? And she shut me down. She never told me anything. She shut me down and she said, that's so painful. Don't you ever talk to me about that. I can't talk about that. It's too painful for me. And you know what? My mom is sensitive and she's fragile, emotionally fragile. My mom was raised in an orphanage from age of 2, and she experienced a lot of abuse. And so in this moment, she shut me down.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. Fifty-one years after she was last seen alive, there remains no proof that Melissa was kidnapped. There have been no credible sightings of Melissa, or the alleged woman named Ruth Johnson, who Alta and Carol told police came to the house and took Melissa to babysit her while Alta was at work. Hearing the story of this Ruth Johnson woman coming to the door and taking Melissa, it was eerie. Who was this woman in white gloves, and what were her intentions? Our first instincts were to wonder if this could have been someone who desperately wanted a child. This did occur prior to modern-day fertility treatments. Could a woman who wanted a child have seen the ad in the paper and came up with this plan to abduct Melissa and raise her as her own? Or perhaps it was someone profiting off of illegal adoptions. Or was this all just a cover story? When we talked to Alta, we couldn't shake the feeling that she knew more than she has shared publicly and throughout our interview with her. We kept wondering if we were really talking to a woman whose child had been stolen by a stranger all those years ago. One thing that concerned us was her expression of resentment that her children were looking for their sister. Is this just a wound that she didn't want reopened, or is there something more? Here's Alta in her own words.
They want me to get involved in everything. And I told them, I said, I've already moved on. It's been 50 years ago, 51 years ago, you know, when Jeff first started doing this. I did a couple. Oh, I take that back in Illinois. I don't know why or how that came about, but I did do an interview in Illinois. And that was like, I don't know, 7 or 8 years before I moved to Fort Worth. I don't know how they got story. I don't remember, but I did do an interview. My daughter Vicki did it with me. That was for a Fox News station or something. I don't remember. And I gave them the same story. And they said, if we find out anything, we'll let you know. And they never did call me back. And then after I retired, I moved to Texas and I stayed with my son, Jack. And he started getting interested in this case and wanted to find out more. And I did another interview. That's been about 3 years ago. But I'm not mad at my kids. If they want to do it, that's fine. I talked to my daughter, Vicki, and I says, Vicki, I can't handle all this. It brings back too many painful memories. And I said, if y'all want to do it, that's fine. But please don't leave me out of it. I can't do it. My daughters, all of them are involved in it, but I just don't want to be right now. I just, if they want to do that, I gave it to God a long time ago.
We asked Alta what would happen if Melissa walked into her home tomorrow and she saw her mom for the first time, since she was too young to remember her.
What would I do? I don't know. Well, if she could prove that she was Melissa, yeah, I would be surprised and I would be thankful and grateful, and I don't know. It's been so long, 51 years ago, and I don't know. Of course, I'd be happy. It would probably be a shock. I don't know. That's just something that I've thought about it a few times, you know, about how it would be if I could see Melissa again. And I don't know. It'd just be something I would, I've dreamed of, but never have seen it as a reality. I mean, you know, after 51 years, you know, it's kind of hard to imagine that you're going to find your daughter after that long a time. But my kids have a lot of faith that they're going to find her. My son asked me a couple of weeks ago if I thought she was still alive, and I said, I don't know. I hope she is. But I didn't tell him before he left. I've always felt like that she was somewhere. I didn't know where, but I never did feel like that she was dead. And I've always prayed that God, wherever she is, that God would take care of her, that he would just protect her. I've always prayed that way. And I have prayed for her off and on. My son said, do you pray for her every day? And I said, no. And I said, he was touching on areas that I didn't want to talk about. So I didn't want to talk to him about it. But I do. I pray for her every once in a while. I pray for all my family.
What is it that Alta doesn't want to talk about? At the conclusion of our research, beyond the possibility that a person calling themselves Ruth Johnson had abducted Melissa, we had two other theories that we believe are plausible. The first is that Melissa was sold in an illegal adoption. We were able to confirm two pieces of information that were some of the only concrete facts we have about Melissa. First, we know that her birth certificate says she was born on November 6, 1969, to Jeffrey and Alta Faye Highsmith. Second, we were able to confirm that no Social Security number was ever issued in her name. Obtaining a new birth certificate in 1971 would have been exceptionally easy, and illegal adoptions were disturbingly more common than we previously thought. We want to reiterate that this is just one of the possible theories we have about what happened to Melissa, and she remains classified by law enforcement as a non-familial abduction. With that said, there is some very coincidental information that lends itself to the possibility that Melissa was sold in an illegal adoption. In 2019, Melissa's brother Jeff did an interview for another true crime podcast called Gone Cold. When we spoke with Jeff, he told us about how his search for his sister began with a death in the family and led him to do that podcast.
So my wife and I married in 2016. It might have been the end of 2017, early 2018, when my aunt had died, my mom's sister had died, and one of my uncles, he came to us at the funeral and said, look, you really do need to go one more time and try to, you know, in 2006, the case was reopened and nothing really happened. No leads were no new leads. And he said, look, you need to find Melissa. It's been, you know, almost 50 years and still nothing there. And his daughter was murdered. One of his twin daughters was murdered by her husband. And the husband was never convicted. And they could never prove it. But he knows that beyond a shadow of a doubt that he murdered his daughter. And so he's had that tragedy and that non-closure in his family. And he said, look, you got to try one more time, and if you can't do it, then just have a memorial, at least put her to rest, and that way your family can get some kind of closure. And so we said, okay, you're right. So we started in late 2017 and 2018, just going over the documents, what we had online, looking at everything that anybody wrote about, you know, started writing everything down. And then we finally were able to do a podcast with Vincent Strange called Gone Cold.
In part one, we told you about a tip coming in that led the family to a man named Oscar, a man they later learned had allegedly illegally adopted another child years ago. Jeff told us his version of how this tip came in, about one of Oscar's other daughters potentially being Melissa.
When we did that podcast, a lady had called in with a tip and was convinced that her cousin was my sister. And we said, okay. And so we said, well, why do you think your cousin is our sister? We had dinner with her. And she said, well, her name is Sandra. Her mother was a drug addict, so she lived with her aunt. Well, her aunt was married to a guy named Oscar. And he said that Oscar lived at the same apartment complex as my mom when my sister was kidnapped. And so that immediately said, whoa. We had a second meeting with Sandra, and it was an audio call with Sandra and her sister on the phone call. But in that interview with Sandra and her sister, Sandra said that there was always a lot of young children, toddlers, over the course probably 4 or 5 years that she lived with them, staying with them for just 24 to 48 hours, and they would be there. And his explanation to his nieces were, these are friends that I'm babysitting. But there was always a lot of them, different times, you know, 3 or 4 at a time. But it was always like every weekend. It was always a lot of kids that would come and they would go, come and they would go. And she's like, it just doesn't make any sense. It's just so weird.
We talked with Vincent Strange, host of Gone Cold, who describes his show as a podcast covering unsolved murders and missing persons cases throughout the state of Texas. After hearing what Jeff had to say, we listened to Vincent's episode about Melissa, and we had some questions for Vincent, who was gracious enough to speak with us about his experience working on Melissa's story. Much of what Vincent was able to share with us, and what he said in his episode covering Melissa's disappearance, he said came from old newspapers and family members. Like us, he was forced to rely on the memory of those willing to speak with him, and neither of the people who had a first-hand account, Alta or Carol, agreed to speak with him, though he did attempt to establish contact with both. He told us he never got a response from Carol, and he didn't get a response from Alta either, but rather from Melissa's brother, Jeff, who said that his mother would not be granting an interview. Vincent sent a list of questions to Jeff for Alta to answer. And this is where the detailed descriptions of what happened on the morning of Melissa's disappearance came from. But it's impossible to know if Alta answered those questions herself, or if someone else filled in the gaps with their best guess as to what happened. Vincent also told us that the Fort Worth police refused to release any records or a statement to him. He was as frustrated as we were at how difficult it was to find anything that could be considered a fact, but wanted to give Melissa's case the coverage it has so desperately needed all of these years. After the Gone Cold episode aired, that's when this tip came in from a woman who said she believed her cousin Becky was possibly Melissa. It certainly sounded like a lead worth pursuing. This is what Jeff told us.
Sandra's the lady that called in with the podcast. That's Oscar's niece by marriage. She said her and her sister stated that Oscar owned a bar at 21, which is really odd, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. She said that it was on Hemp Hill. So we don't know. We're just taking everything at her word. We don't know if he maybe was a manager of a bar or if he worked at the bar and they thought he owned it, but they said that he owned it. I'm like, okay, well, all right, that's what you say. And we said, we asked if she knew the name of the bar. And she said she couldn't remember or didn't know. She'll have to find out, but knew that it was on Hemp Hill at the time. Like, okay, well, that's kind of broad, but okay. He still owns that building there. From what Sandra and even Becky, this girl Becky, who is his adopted daughter, that's what they said, that Oscar always had a wad of cash in his pocket. However, he was not an educated man. He was not a smart guy. He was not book smart whatsoever. It didn't make sense to them how he always had so much money. They just didn't see. It didn't make sense to them how he made all that money just off that store, because it's not a booming store. We think it was just another front. It was a legitimate way to launder his money.
We checked property records for Tarrant County and the surrounding areas and found no indication that Oscar owns more than a handful of properties and has never owned a bar. The building Jeff claims Oscar still owns is a vacant lot, not owned by Oscar. Regardless, the bar was within walking distance of Alta and Carol's apartment. And Jeff told us that the tip he received from Vincent tied Oscar not only to the illegal adoption trade, but also to the apartment complex where Alta and Melissa lived.
I called Oscar. I said, you know, we're just following up a lead and we just need to, you know, this, your name came up and this guy just said that you lived at this apartment complex at this time, 69 to 71, and without hesitation. I mean, like just right off the top of his list. Yeah, me and my family lived there at that time. Okay, that's all we need to know. Thank you so much. So I heard it from his own mouth. After I found out that this guy obviously is kind of shady. He just denied it. Why would you just deny it after you gave it up so fast and said, okay, yeah, I lived there. So there's obviously, you obviously lived there. Sandra and her sister both said they lived there. That was a red flag.
Jeff told us that he was able to connect with Becky, who had also questioned her origin story and couldn't erase that she saw the resemblance between herself and the other Highsmith siblings, as well as Melissa's age-progressed photo.
You know, by this time, we thought that her cousin Becky was our sister. Becky had the hips and thighs like my mom and sisters. Her daughters had the hips and thighs. Her daughters looked like my sisters. Becky looked just like my mom. And then on top of that, Becky also had a birthmark on the back of her neck, just like Melissa. And we were convinced. We're like, this is her. We know this. We got it tested any lab test now on Arlington. So, but DNA said no. We got hurt. That really did hurt. We're now we're questioning the validity of the DNA test. Now we are. We don't know. It was recommended by Becky's daughter. We didn't think anything of it. Like, yeah, we'll go there. We paid for the test, you know, so like, absolutely, we'll go test there. Now we're kind of questioning the validity of it. And I put a picture side by side of Oscar when he was probably in his mid-40s next to what a composite sketch of Carol gave of the kidnapper. And a chill went down my spine because to me, it, like the eyes, the nose, the mouth, the cheekbones, it looked just like him. It looked just like him. And then Carol, the roommate that handed Melissa to the kidnapper, said that she later on said this week she thought it was a guy dressed in drag. And we also have questions about Carol.
We don't know enough about this kind of privately owned DNA testing lab that isn't a large commercial platform like Ancestry or 23andMe. So we can't share our opinion on it with you. But from what we know, no one ever took this lead to law enforcement and asked them to conduct a DNA analysis for a familial match. We didn't ask Jeff why he didn't go through law enforcement, but we can't blame him for choosing to go his own route based on our own firsthand experiences with the Fort Worth Police Department. In early October, we contacted the Fort Worth Police Department to find out who was assigned to Melissa's case. Consistent with our previous interactions with Fort Worth, they didn't respond to multiple emails until we went up the chain of command. And then something strange happened. Sergeant John Phillips, who we interacted with during our work on the Carolyn Riggins story, said the following to us and to Melissa's family. I've been handling the Highsmith case for the last few years. Sergeant Phillips is a supervisor over the Major Crimes Unit. We were able to verify with two separate divisions at the police department that he doesn't carry a caseload and is not assigned to investigate Melissa's case. This left us in a tough position, without being able to even find out who the investigator is, or if there is one at all. We weren't able to ask for an interview or attempt to verify information. Furthermore, we learned important information that could be critical to finding Melissa, but we have no one to contact. Melissa's family has also been trying to establish meaningful communication with the department, and when asked why they never received a callback after a tip came in from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, Sergeant Phillips responded days later with the following, which we are reading exactly as he stated via email. I'm sorry to hear that your brother had an expectation that I would call him back that I was unaware of. I clearly recall speaking with him about the anonymous tip regarding the age progression picture that was released by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. I was also aware that follow-up stories had been done to share with the public a Fort Worth PD number that people with information could use to contact me. I have also been in contact with representatives from NCMEC and share their hope that information beyond the anonymous tip is forthcoming. I ensured that your brother had multiple phone numbers to contact me directly if the need should arise. I will share those numbers with you. I prefer to the extent possible to deal with a single family representative, who could then communicate with the larger family group. I assure you that I'm eager to find a resolution for you and your family. However, I have not seen the text of the tip that came to Charleston, and was led to believe that due to the anonymous nature of the tip, additional information from that source was unlikely. While Sergeant Phillips states that he is eager to find a resolution for the Highsmith family, his most recent message came only after a week of daily emails to him and read as follows. I'm willing to meet with you, coordinate a day which works best for you and your family, and I will work to accommodate you. I am unavailable the evening of November 16th and most of the day on the 17th, and of course the Thanksgiving holiday. Beyond that, I must be responsive to critical police incidents. To the Highsmiths, it didn't sound like Sergeant Phillips was eager to find Melissa or do much to help their family. In fact, the tone of his email reminded us of Police Chief Neil Noakes' response when we contacted him about the police department refusing to investigate the claims of child sexual abuse in the Teresa Kennedy and Bethany Tyner case that we shared with you earlier this year, in which Chief Noakes stated that his department never wants to hear about a minor being abused. And most recently, when the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children tweeted about an anonymous tip regarding Melissa in South Carolina, the Fort Worth police spokesperson said only that they were delighted about the tip and hoped it was Melissa. Because of the nonchalant tone of these communications, we have to wonder if the Fort Worth Police Department ever cared about Melissa's case at all. Our records requests were swiftly denied, though the Highsmith family is continuing to press for their release. This is what Melissa's sister Rebecca said about that.
I'm so curious as to why they don't want to release the records. Is it because they screwed up and they didn't investigate properly, or they dropped the ball on something, or I don't know, something? Like, why can't we see the records? They're obviously not working this case, and they're not working it. We want to work it. My mom, she doesn't remember a lot of things. You know, the only thing we have are electronic images of her. I don't know where the physical copies of her pictures are. And that would also be something that would be found in the Fort Worth police file.
When we asked Alta how she felt about the police investigation, she told us the following.
I don't think they did as much as they could have.
The police wanted me to take a lie detector test. I guess they figured that I had something to do with it. You always point to the mom first. Well, I didn't take it because there was another police officer standing by, and he said, you know what? And he had seen how they were kind of grilling me, asking me questions, and they brought a bag of clothes in that were not even even Melissa's clothes. And they said, do you recognize any of these? You know, they were grilling me. Well, I was crying, and they showed me those clothes, and I said, those aren't Melissa's clothes. I don't recognize any of them. And a policeman or whoever was standing there listening, and I said, I'm leaving. I'm going home. So I went home, I was thinking about getting a polygraph. And this guy says, you know, you don't have to take that polygraph test. They can't make you do anything that you don't want to do. I didn't have an attorney. This guy, I think, felt sorry for me because he saw how they were treating me. And he said, you don't have to take that. He said, don't let them treat me like that. So I walked out and I went home. The newspapers called me. I don't remember which ones. I don't know. Star Telegram was one of them. And then there was a newscast that came and interviewed me, and I told them exactly what happened. I mean, I'd been going over this all over and over and over, and I was just tired and depressed, and I had nobody to run to talk to. My brother Terry, that normally I went to. He lived out of town, and he wasn't there.
There were so many things that we wished we could have learned about the early investigation into Melissa's disappearance that could have helped to verify Alta and Carol's stories. Did police canvass the apartment complex? Did anyone else see the person claiming to be Ruth Johnson? Did any neighbor hear the loud vehicle Carol mentioned the alleged kidnapper was driving? Had any other mothers in the area had similar encounters? Was someone matching the description given by Carol? At least for now, all of the answers to those questions remain a mystery. Before you book any brunch, you pore over lists and lists of reviews. So why not do the same when you're booking a doctor's appointment? With ZocDoc, you can see real verified patient reviews to help you find the right doctor in your network, in your neighborhood. After all, finding the right doctor is just as, if not more, important than finding the right plate of Eggs Benedict. ZocDoc is a free app that shows you doctors who are patient-reviewed, take your insurance, and are available when you need them. On ZocDoc, you can find every specialist under the sun. Whether you're trying to straighten those teeth, fix an achy back, or get that mole checked out, or anything else, ZocDoc has you covered. ZocDoc's mobile app is as easy as ordering a ride to a restaurant or getting delivery to your house. Search, find, and book doctors with a few taps. Read verified patient reviews from people who made real appointments. Now, when you walk into that doctor's office, you're all set to see someone in your network who gets you. Go to ZocDoc.com, find the doctor that's right for you, and book an appointment in person or remotely that works for your schedule. Every month, millions of people use ZocDoc, and I'm one of them. It's my go-to for whenever I need to find and book a quality doctor. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then start your search for a top-rated doctor today. Many are available within 24 hours. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
There's always an added layer of difficulty when we cover older cases. Police files are often lost, destroyed, or never existed. Earlier this year, we covered the case of Cynthia Constantine, a teenage girl missing from New York since 1969, 2 years before Melissa disappeared. The police in that case told us the records were in an archival storage unit that they weren't positive they knew the location of. And then there are the faded memories that come with the passage of time. In Cynthia's case, her brother William was the only remaining relative alive, and we had to rely solely on his memory of events from 50 years ago, similar to what Alta and Jeff have to try to remember. But in Melissa's case, there were some extra unnecessary obstacles that seemed to continue to get in our way, almost as though distractions were being thrown up in front of us. First, there was a troublesome series of events in which an internet troll attempted to deter the Highsmith family from working with us and express their anger publicly that we did not interview them or include them in our work on the case. To be frank, it was unclear what they would have had to offer beyond further internet speculation. And then, there was a truly vexing event we are still not able to fully comprehend. We learned that one particular family member had gone to such lengths in conducting their own investigation that they impersonated law enforcement, fabricated information about another law enforcement entity's involvement, and had essentially filled in the gaps of the story that can't be proven with their own speculation. This made our work exponentially more difficult, as we had to go line by line through our interviews, trying to corroborate information against old newspapers, what other podcasters like Vincent Strange and Gone Cold had learned, and the information that simply made the most sense. In the end, we want to acknowledge Melissa's dad, Jeff Highsmith, whose unwavering story has remained consistent over the years, and he has been so gracious in giving interviews, despite how difficult it is for him to talk about losing his firstborn child. When we talked with him, he especially wanted to reiterate that he doesn't want to place blame on anyone. But there is one specific reason he left Alta the second time around.
I don't want to hurt anybody, and this is what broke the camel's back and why I left. My son was, he was almost 18, and I think he wrecked our car. And of course, I was upset with him. She was furious with him. Well, he came over about a year later, and she jumped on him, and she said, just to give you an idea, she said, I hope you die a slow death and rot in hell. I mean, that really made me mad that a mother would say that to her own son. I mean, I was just so angry over that. That's one of the things that caused me to leave. I said, I'm not going to live this way anymore. She was really hateful. I mean, I wasn't perfect. I'm not trying to say that. I hope you die a slow death. Now, that's cruel and rot in hell. That's her own kid. And I just, terrible, terrible thing to say. I left the home in 1998. So he was 18. So I waited till all my kids were grown. I didn't want to make the same mistake as I did the first time and not support my children. And I was much more mature, and I've been going to church for years.
This horrifying account of Alta telling her son she hoped he died a slow death was witnessed by at least one of her other children as well. And we were told it remained vividly with them for years. For that, we cannot imagine how Jeff must have been affected and the trauma he has experienced growing up without a sibling. And it explains, though does not absolve, the fact that when we confronted him about information he gave us that turned out to be false, he turned into a different, very scary person. After giving him the opportunity to be honest with us privately, given that everything he had told us was thrown into question, after we discovered a pattern of dishonesty in the things he said, this is how he responded to us.
Rape, don't interfere with my investigation with my sister either. I got motherfucking resources too. Count on it. You don't even know what the fuck I'm talking about. You have no idea what I've done for 6 years, what my wife and I haven't uncovered. You have no fucking clue who my friends are that are lawyers, that are very smart people. You don't know my investigation. You don't know my angle. You don't know anything about what the fuck I'm talking about. So go ahead and fucking call the Fort Worth Police Department. I don't fucking care. Do what the fuck you gotta do. I'm gonna do what the fuck I gotta do. Get the fuck out of here.
We know that Jeff was speaking from a place of hurt, trauma, and anger, not unlike the ways that Alta lashed out at him and his siblings. His life has been unquestionably difficult, and we recognize that he is also a victim in this. But we also must acknowledge that being verbally abused by anyone is unacceptable, and this was only one more hurdle we had to face in working on the second part of this story. Every family member we spoke to has their own pain and traumas, from all of the compounding factors that we see all too often in the family dynamics of those with a missing loved one. In Melissa's case, this seems to be especially exacerbated. Still, each person has done their best to move forward without letting Melissa's disappearance consume them. Jeff has remarried since he left Alta after their youngest child, Jeff, turned 18, and he told us that he has finally found a marriage that works.
I'm remarried. It was 2 years after I left. I mean, I liked being married. I enjoyed the family life. I enjoyed children. And I really enjoy the family environment. 2 years after me and Alta, she asked for the divorce after the fact, about a year. And I'm the one that paid for the divorce because she wanted a divorce. And the next day after the divorce, she got married, or next couple of days, to a guy. And That didn't last but about a year. Nevertheless, I got married 2 years after we separated, and I'm just happy as can be. And my current wife, we never, ever, ever argue. We have the best relationship. I can't believe how good a marriage I have after living for 27 years in a miserable relationship. But I'm ecstatic with my marriage now.
This has helped Jeff heal from the gaping hole left in his heart by Melissa's disappearance, finding happiness and enjoying the four children that he does have. Jeff was very transparent and forthcoming with the mistakes he made, things that he thinks may have prevented Melissa's disappearance. But it's impossible to know. So he has chosen to make the best of the relationship he has with his children, and he remains resilient in his hope that Melissa will be found, and expressed his genuine desire to know what happened to her before he passes away. Though Alta may simply express her emotions differently, she seems to have a different perspective on how she feels about her children looking for Melissa today, the possibility that she might be found, and how her life has transpired over the last 50 years. In her own unedited words, she shared this with us.
I pray for her every once in a while. I pray for all my family, you know, and so I don't know. But I would love to see Melissa again. It wouldn't be the same, of course, all those years of mess. But if I can ever talk to her again, that would be wonderful. I've heard also that she could have been taken by a child person that kidnapped children and sold them. People that wanted a baby and couldn't have one. But Jeff, my son, thinks that it was a man that took her. I don't know if I understand that, but I just wished I knew where. But, you know, wherever she is, I believe God has been taking care of her. And I believe that she's had a good life. And I hope that, well, I know that as young as she was, she won't remember any of that. So I don't think she would blame me. I mean, she was too young to know what was going on. And maybe the person that took her has made her her own daughter. You know, that's what I've always hoped. And I don't want to believe that God, I mean, I didn't know God in a personal way back then. I wasn't going to church. And I don't want to believe that God would punish me for not being in church or being a Christian or I don't know. I don't think God's like that. I just have to believe that God did what he thought was best for Melissa. I don't know. Maybe he saw how bad of a mother, I mean, what kind of a mother lets her child be kidnapped? What kind of a mother doesn't check up the people to take her daughter? So I always thought I was a bad mother for letting that happen. I just felt like I could have done more to find a better babysitter or something. I don't know. Maybe I couldn't, but I blamed myself a lot. For a long time I did. And I blamed Jeff also. And I've had to work through those feelings. And I've come to the place where I was at peace with all of those feelings until the last couple of years or so. And I just, you know, my kids want to find her. And you know, I think that's great for them. But whatever is God's will, that's going to happen. I believe that God has got her. I believe he's got taken care of her all these years. I believe that with all my heart. And I believe God has forgiven me for letting her slip out of my hands so easily. I've tried to forgive Jeff. I think I have forgiven him. But when these feelings come, I get bad feelings, you know, and I don't know. I've tried to forgive him, and I think I have. I think I'm past that. I don't know how the kids feel about me. You know, three weeks ago when Vicki was in here talking to me, you know, and you know, I found out that he was going to South Carolina instead of Jeff's wife, which I didn't know that she had to work.
But when I found out that he was gone, I thought, that just hit me so bad. And I had a complete meltdown. I told my daughter, I said, where was he when she was kidnapped? Where was he before she was kidnapped? He didn't send me any money. He didn't send any support. And I just went on and on. I said, you know, he didn't care about us. He left us for someone else. And he didn't even care about us after we were in Texas. And that's why I just get, that's why I try to stay away from, you know, talking about these things, you know, because I bring back a lot of bad memories.
Whatever bad memories it is that Alta has regarding Melissa's disappearance, her children see and recognize that she has been traumatized repeatedly since birth and repeated those early childhood learned behaviors throughout her life, likely doing the best she knows how to do. We asked Victoria what she believes happened to her sister, especially since she seems to have been treated very harshly, perhaps because she was born just a year after her older sister Rebecca, and Alta didn't want another child so soon. Or maybe it's because she reminded Alta of Melissa in some way. We simply don't know. What we do know is that Victoria holds no grudges against her mother.
I believe to be the case that my mother was at work and that she left the baby with Carol. I believe that to be the truth. I would hope that my mother would never be a part of something happening to my sister. I mean, you never want to believe that about a parent, that they would do something like that to their child. And I don't know, I don't know Carol besides what I heard from my mother. And I asked how she knew Carol. And she's like, well, we went to the, we grew up in the orphanage together. So it's just a sad situation that my dad wasn't around when that happened. Because sometimes I wonder if my dad would have been around, maybe my mother wouldn't have been working and she would have been home with Melissa. So I don't know, woulda, coulda, shoulda, you know. I don't think my mother had anything to do with it. I think she feels guilty that she entrusted someone to watch her child and this person ran off with her child. I would feel guilty for the rest of my life. I would feel like it was my fault too, because I had to work, but I was trying to get a sitter for the child. And now look what happened. Like, and then that's something I would have to carry for the rest of my life. My mom's had to carry this her whole life. She's had to carry this burden. I just hope we find my sister, because, you know, I know that's been an empty spot in my mother and father's life. You know, that was the first child. There's four of us, but there's one more of us. There's five of us. There's not four of us. There's five of us. And once we knew there was five of us, it was hard to forget that. And what my brother started working on the case tirelessly 6 years ago. And I've never met my sister, but I get emotional about it sometimes when I see the pictures. And because it's my sister, she's out there somewhere. She's missing. And I could probably walk right past her and wouldn't even know it. It was her. The goal is, I hope we find my sister. It would definitely bring closure to our family. And I think it would make my mom really happy. She's been unhappy for as long as I can remember. And I'm hoping, you know, Melissa being gone and us finding her would really bring a lot of peace and closure to my mother. Closure of pain that she's and guilt that she's been walking around with all these years. And, you know, my dad, he'll get to see his daughter again. She's probably got children that's got children. You know, like, we could probably have a whole nother family out here somewhere. So I'm really hoping we find her.
For Melissa's second sister, Sharon, there aren't a lot of outcomes she thinks are plausible in her sister's case.
I think there's a couple of probabilities. And that's it. I honestly, we're just searching for answers. Our family, the siblings, have carried this trauma. My mom and dad are so tired. Like, they're so tired of people coming forward. And my dad is super eager. He's always super eager to just, he'll go with the flow. He'll do whatever. But he's tired too. My mom and dad are tired of this. And so it's us. It's the siblings, the ones that are chasing the story, chasing the leads, chasing the tips. I'm on GEDmatch. So my mom's kit, my brother's kit, my sister's kit, and my dad's kit all uploaded to this website.
Melissa's third sister, Rebecca, firmly believes that she's out there, in hopes that social media and genetic genealogy will lead her family to finding Melissa.
I think that she was abducted by someone who wanted a child. Maybe they had lost a child, and so they were looking to find someone to replace their lost child, or they couldn't have children, and so they were looking for a baby to have. That's always been my feeling. I've always thought that she was alive somewhere and always had this hope that we would find her one day. But it's always so, like, how do you start? Like, where do you start? With my brother, like, starting this Facebook page and podcasts and such, it kind of, like, gives us new hope with the way technology is now, that it's a possibility, especially with how everyone is wanting to get their DNA tested to find out their ancestry. I'm the oldest. I mean, because Melissa's not here, but it's not who I'm supposed to be. So it just knowing if she's alive, I think would be enough for my parents. It's really emotional. Like my whole life, I think that I had to take on the role of the big sister who fixed everything and took care of everybody. And I'm in that role. This is my role my whole life. And I don't think it was mine. It's not my role. I just want people to share this story. I'm sure that there will be other people who can relate to this story.
And Jeff, too, has a theory about what he thinks happened to his oldest sister.
They thought my mom had something to do with Melissa's disappearance. We think the old boys club kind of focused on my mom and really let a lot of good police work probably possibly go untouched. How come Oscar was never interviewed by the FBI or the Fort Worth Police Department? If he lived at the same apartment complex, how come he was never interviewed? How come he was never questioned? You know, my mom and dad were separated at the time. My mom was a single mother with a 2-year-old baby girl in a very stressful situation. I think that, you know, Carol knew that Oscar was at the bar at least, and that we believe that Oscar was a middleman for trafficking kids. And we think that Oscar stroked up the conversation stating, hey, Carol talked about her roommate's 2-year-old and how she's miserable or, you know, going through stuff. But at least that's my theory. And there's so many questions with Carol that we need to have asked. She will not talk to us. Well, why wouldn't you talk to us? We never came at her like she was a suspect. Never once. She was never a suspect. The whole story is like, wait a second, man. This doesn't make any sense.
So what happened to 21-month-old Melissa Highsmith? We're basically left with three possible outcomes. One we shared with you was the possibility that Melissa was sold in an illegal adoption. We do believe this is a plausible theory. But there's another possibility too, and it would be irresponsible of us to ignore it, on the basis that it's an uncomfortable possibility that no one wants to speak of, but probably every parent can relate to. Alta was a young, newly single mother. She had to find housing, transportation, childcare, and a job with very few resources. She didn't have many options. She worked long hours and was likely exhausted by all of the responsibilities she was shouldering as a single mother. Is it possible that there was an accident in which Melissa was accidentally shaken too hard, or pushed against something and suffered a fatal injury, or in some other manner ended up dead? We know Alta has a short fuse. It's not a pleasant or comfortable place for our minds to go, but we will always remain true to the goal of our work, and that is to examine and explore all possibilities, no matter how uncomfortable they may be. Or was this Ruth Johnson a real person who responded to the classified ad that Alta placed in the paper and came to the door that day with the intention of keeping Melissa? We don't have the answers, but Melissa's family remains hopeful that answers will come, especially considering the new technologies we have today, like genetic genealogy. At the time of Melissa's disappearance, she was just a couple months shy of her second birthday. She had brown hair and hazel eyes. She has a birthmark on her upper back near her neck, described by her family as a tomato birthmark, a reddish spot that was several inches in diameter at the time she vanished. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Melissa Highsmith, we urge you to call any law enforcement agency you can reach.
She overheard a conversation between her father, Oscar, and her aunt, Oscar's sister. And in that conversation, they said something, his sister, Oscar's sister, said something to the effect of, "We know that Becky isn't your real child, and we know where you got her." She never confronted her dad about it. She's just sort of kept it a secret that she heard that, overheard that. And so that created doubt for her. That's the reason why she was willing to go with Jeff to get a DNA test. According to Becky and the rest of the family, Oscar is a great man. He is a great father. He's a good grandfather. He's just a wonderful, a stand-up human being. I mean, I'm not surprised that he's gotten away with it if he did do something, but I also am not saying that he did do something. It's just the family wants something. We want to see something, and my brother has focused on that, and he focuses on that because, I don't know, I think you see what you want to see, you know? Rachel said that when she sat down and met Becky for the first time, she was in shock at how much she looked similar to my mom. In the end, they did do a DNA test, but they didn't do it through Ancestry, and they just can't let that go. They can't let that go. Meeting her and seeing her and speaking to her, they can't let it go that looked so similar to mom. That brings us to the end of episode 372. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. Special thanks to Vincent Strange from Gone Cold. Be sure to check out his show wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you like our show, please give us a 5-star rating and review. You can also support the show by contributing on Patreon. Next week, we'll be taking a break to spend some time remembering all that we're grateful for and enjoying the company of our loved ones. We hope that you do the same, and we'll be back with a new episode from the state of Washington on December 5th. Thanks for listening. Hey Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.